Well, welcome to the Mathematical Institute and our talk, Love and Math. I think there's something quite exciting about seeing signs pointing towards the Maths Institute saying Love and Math this way. I hope you're not all expecting sort of group hugs or anything like this, but there'll be lots of exciting maths and love of maths. So we're very excited. This is part of a wonderful conference that's been going on for the last few days, looking at lots of interactions between different areas of mathematics, looking at symmetry and correspondences. And Professor Edward Frankel is going to be talking about one of the most exciting correspondences in mathematics, something called the Langlands program. So the idea for the next hour is that Edward's going to kick off, tell us a little bit about the subject of his book, which is called Love and Math, the mathematical story at the heart of that book. Then we're going to be in conversation for a short while, and then I will open up the floor for you to join in the conversation and pose some questions to Edward and about the book and mathematics and love. But anyway, it's a great pleasure to have Edward here, professor of mathematics at the University of Berkeley and author of this wonderful new book, Love and Math. So over you to Edward.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Marcus, for such a great introduction. Can you guys hear me well? It's such a great pleasure to be here at Oxford University Mathematics Institute, Andrew Wiles building. It's a new building. It's the first time I'm here, and it's just so wonderful. I will have a very hard time leaving this place, so I might stick around longer. And thank you all for coming. It's such a great pleasure to have you all here. I want to talk today about love and math. And so, as Marcus said, the arrow was pointing, if you wanted to get some of that, so then you should come here. So yeah, now I have to show you something to convince you that there is a link between the two. So what I want to start with is this beautiful quote from Galileo. He said, the laws of nature are written in the language of mathematics. And he said, without mathematics, one is left wandering in a dark labyrinth. So it kind of suggests that mathematics is a language. But what kind of language is it? Is it kind of a universal language, which means the same thing to everyone? Is there only one mathematics? This sounds a little bit abstract. So let's ask a slightly more concrete question. If we were to meet aliens, would aliens have the same math? And you can imagine aliens like this, or could be something else. But actually, it's no longer just a subject of sci-fi movies. We now know that there are quite a few planets out there which could theoretically, in principle, support intelligent life, like this one, which was found, Kepler-186f, an Earth-sized planet which was found recently, just a few months ago. But what if intelligence does not take the form of those little creatures that we usually imagine? What if it is a Solaris-like intelligence? Some of you may have seen the old film of Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, based on a novel of Stanislav Lem, in which a whole planet was sentient, was intelligent, and could interact with other creatures. So the question then would be, would Solaris-like intelligence have exactly the same math as we do? Because one could argue that perhaps not, because there is only one of it. It's not just one alien, two alien, three alien. There is only one Solaris. So would it be able to discover numbers? And the point I'd like to make is actually, I believe that Solaris would discover numbers, but discover them in a different way. And this is an important point, that mathematics, there are many different portals into the same concepts and ideas in mathematics. Mathematics is kind of unified. The different parts of mathematics are connected in unexpected ways. And this is a very good example. Numbers could be discovered not necessarily by counting. You could also discover them through winding. And this is a simple experiment. My dentist always insists that I do floss. I don't do enough of that. But I carry the thing with me, so I feel good about myself, But actually, this is a very good example, because when you do flossing, you actually wrap this thing, this thread on your finger, and then you can count the number of times that you wrap it around. And if you wrap it, say, counterclockwise, then you count them as positive numbers. If there is no winding at all, then 0, and clockwise, negative 1, negative 2, negative 3, and so on. Now, one could say that this is actually, in some sense, a better way of discovering integers, the whole numbers, than by counting. Because, you know, when we teach our children numbers, we tell them, well, look, you have one apple, two apples, three apples, and so on. But then they say, but these apples are different, so why are you combining them together? But windings are exactly the same, you know? So this is it's kind of a pure numbers. They are actually alike. So going back to Solaris-type intelligence, a Solaris-type intelligence could discover in the same way numbers, because here we talk about wrapping, you know, a thread, but also a sphere could wrap on itself many times, and with positive orientation, with negative orientation, as mathematicians say. And so this way, a Solaris would discover numbers through winding. This is what mathematicians call homotopy groups, and it's a portal into one very important area, a branch of mathematics. So mathematics really, to me, and this is a point which I try to convey in my book, Love and Math, is a kind of a hidden parallel universe, which is full of elegance and beauty and intricately intertwined with our world. But it is a world of its own, a kind of a platonic reality of ideas to which we connect in some way and discover those truths. So the way I like to think about math really is kind of a jigsaw puzzle. So you have all these many different pieces, and you try to assemble them into a meaningful picture. But you don't know what the final image is going to look like. That's what doing mathematics is about to me. And so it becomes something like this. So you know, a kind of a jigsaw puzzle. But also, I like to think of mathematics as containing this, you know, many different continents. And so, like, what are the continents of mathematics? One is number theory, the study of numbers. So we just talked about the integers, the whole numbers. But that's just the beginning, because once you study whole numbers, then you have fractions. Once you have fractions, then you can do things like square root of 2. You realize it's not a fraction, so it's an irrational number. Not because it acts irrationally, but because it's not a ratio of two integers. And then little by little you discover more and more. So that's the study of numbers. This is number theory. But there is another area of mathematics which is called harmonic analysis. That's another continent of mathematics. And harmonics, of course, we perceive the most sort of the most clear way when we listen to music. The sound of symphony is composed from the sounds of different instruments. And every note can be thought of as a wave. And the wave can be represented as a, you know, as a kind of a graph of the sine, cosine function. And so these are the harmonics. These different sounds are harmonics. But then we combine them together and impose them upon each other. And together they combine into this beautiful sound of a symphony. So this is the idea that a general signal could be decomposed, could be broken into pieces, and pieces being these elementary harmonics. That's the idea of harmonic analysis, which has been very important and very useful in mathematics. And so at the outset, these two continents of mathematics, the number theory and harmonic analysis, look totally different. But we now understand, although there were some connections found earlier, but this man, Robert Langlands, about 45 years ago, a little more, came up with some groundbreaking ideas which connected these two different continents, these two different worlds of number theory and harmonic analysis, and much more. Here's Langlands, is a picture of Langlands taken in 1999 at his office at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Participants of this conference have seen this Langlands in this office on the first day, watching him give a talk exactly at this office, which, by the way, is the office which used to belong to Albert Einstein. And actually, if you look at Einstein's, some of the pictures of Einstein in his office, you will see the similarities, because many of the things are preserved the same way as they were with Einstein. And so I often, you know, I make kind of a half a joke, I say that, you know, everybody knows about Einstein and his relativity theory, and rightly so. But very few people know about Langlands. And I think that you know, the Langlands program, the work that Langlands initiated 45, 50 years ago, perhaps is just as important as relativity theory. And many more of us should know about it. And perhaps it will yield applications just as important as Einstein's relativity. But first, let's talk about it. What is it about? So there are many, many things and many parts in the Langlands program. And I talk about this in great detail in my book. But I just wanted to focus on one particular aspect of it, which is a bridge, a connection between two different continents of mathematics. One is number theory, and the other one is harmonic analysis. And so to explain for non-specialists, I just want to say a couple of words here. We look at what's called the clock arithmetic. If you start work at 9 in the morning and you work for 8 hours, when do you finish? Well, 9 plus 8 is 17, but we don't say 17, right? We say 5 o'clock. How do we get 5? We get 5 by subtracting 12 from 17. So 9 plus 8 is not 17 in this clock arithmetic, but 5. That's what we get, and we call it modulo 12, meaning that it's 5 up to addition of 12, or it could be multiple of 12, like 24 and so on. So this clock arithmetic is used not only on a clock with 12 hours, but it could also be used on a clock with any number of hours. It could be 5 hours, 7 hours, 10 hours, and so on. But in mathematicians like to consider clocks in which number of hours is a prime number. So it's a number which is not divisible by a whole number, which is not divisible by any other whole number except for 1 in itself. So here are the first few, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13. So here's a clock with 7 hours. That's what it's going to look like. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to look at equations and try to solve those equations using these new rules, using this numerical system of clock arithmetic. Okay? So for example, this kind of cubic equation is a good example. You have two variables, x and y, and you have an equation. So we will look for numbers x and y such that if you substitute into this equation, the left-hand side is equal to the right-hand side. But we look for numbers, whole numbers, so that the equation is satisfied, but within this framework of clock arithmetic, so modulo some prime number. So they're not equal on the nose, but they could be, but they're equal up to a multiple of this prime number p. And then we'd like to count the solutions. We count the number of such solutions. So here is a simple example. Let's say p is 5, and what are the solutions? So first of all, of course, if you put 0 and 0, 0 equals 0, that's fine. But and likewise, x is 1 and y is 0. But here's one. X is 0, y is 4. Oops, went too far. If y is 4, you get 16 plus 4, which is 20. And x is 0, is it 0. So 20 is not equal to 0 in the normal sense. But it is equal. They're equal to each other modulo 5, because 20 is divisible by 5. So 20 is 0 modulo 5. So we got another solution then. And there is one more. So there are 4 solutions altogether. That's the kind of problem that we study in number theory. And now, and it looks like a super esoteric problem, which has could not possibly have any connections to anything. But actually, a year ago, we found out that exactly this kind of equations were used to insert various weaknesses into encryption protocols. And so it was, of course, a big deal. And there is still a fallout is continuing. We're still learning more and more of what was going on and how mathematics was used, and perhaps one could argue abused by the powers that be. Some really sophisticated, complicated mathematics. And my point is, it's exactly mathematics of cubic equations like that, modulo primes. So it's called elliptic curve cryptography. You consider equations of this type. Here's another example. It's called an elliptic curve. And you use them for encryption. I don't want to get too technical, but there is some very special property of solutions of these equations that if you have two solutions, you can produce a third. This is what mathematicians call a group. And so that property is used to set up, for example, pseudo-random number generators. And the efficiency of such a generator is predicated upon the fact that there's a certain problem on this elliptic curve that is very hard to solve. I mean, it will be impossible to solve even on a very sophisticated network of computers. It's called a discrete logarithm problem. It doesn't matter at this point what exactly the details are. But I want to show you that I'm not lying to you, that here's a US government document. This is not classified, so don't worry. We will not have to kill you afterwards. So. from July 1999. And see, the federal government recommended elliptic curves, elliptic curve cryptography. Here is another publication which became very notorious in the last year since the revelations about the NSA scandal came to light by NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology in the United States. These are recommendations for random number generators which in particular use elliptic curve. One of the generators which they propose uses elliptic curve. This is the algorithm, this is how it works. And it's a selection of an appropriate elliptic curve in appendix A1. So we turn pages and we get to appendix A1 and see here's the equation, y squared, x cubed, and there's some number b. Number b is given, I cut it so they could read. Modulo prime, and here's the prime, you see. This is the number of hours that they have on their clock to do this calculation, to do this, generate these prime numbers. So this is bread and butter of modern encryption. And these generators are all everywhere. They're used to run other algorithms for encryption. And now we know, and this actually came to light very, very soon after this NIST publication was published in 2007, two Microsoft researchers said, look, there is a possibility of a backdoor. There was no comment from NIST, from any other organization, but now we find out that perhaps that there was. And in fact, a company, RSA Security, which was producing these generators, they shortly after this information came to light, they told their clients to stop using those generators. And more recently, just 2 months ago, NIST finally dumped this random number generator without any comment, saying, yeah, we should not use it, perhaps. So that's the power of mathematics. This is where we live now. We live in a brave new world in which a mathematical formula could be just as powerful as a nuclear bomb. Maybe the effect is not as visible, but it could be just as lasting. And I think it's very important for us as citizens of this brave new world to be aware of this. It doesn't mean that we have to know all the details of what's going on, but just understand the general context and how mathematics could be used and abused. There is a video I did. I don't want to talk more about this. There is a wonderful YouTube channel, Numberphile, which is run by Brady Heron, who is here in England, in Nottingham. And he has almost 1 million subscribers. So I highly recommend it. And he asked me to explain this. We did a video in December in which I explained more details. If you're interested in the subject, that's where you can find more details. But I wanted to use this quote. Georg Cantor, the great German mathematician, creator of the theory of infinity, said, the essence of mathematics lies in its freedom. In other words, you're free to do, there's a very small number of rules which you have to follow, but within those rules, you're free. You can let your imagination run wild, and you can go as far as you want. But I also want to sort of turn this around, and I want to say, and I think that the example we just considered lends support to this thesis, that where there is no mathematics, there is no freedom. But let's go back to the language program. So we're looking at the equations of this type, and then we look at solutions modulo primes, but different primes, not necessarily 5, but also 5 and 7, all of them at the same time. And for each of them, we try to find how many solutions there are, okay, for each prime. So here I compiled, for these specific equations, I compiled this list. So here's the prime, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13. Of course, it goes on to infinity. And for each of these primes, one can count number of solutions. So for example, for p equals 5, we actually counted earlier, there are 4 solutions. And now I want to form a number which is called a of p, p being a prime, which I'll just take p minus that number. So for example, here p is 2, and number is 4, so is you get 2 minus 4 is minus 4. So you subtract second colon number from the first colon number. So 3 minus 4, negative 1. I hope I didn't make any arithmetic mistakes. Please tell me if I did. But for example, 5. 5, you get 5 minus 4 is 1. So the number a of 5 is 1. And so on. But it becomes more and more complicated. As the number grows, of course, it's going to be more complicated with more solutions. It grows more or less like p, but there is sort of a defect. This is what we are measuring. So the question is, what are these numbers? They look totally random. Doesn't seem to be any, so totally chaotic. Doesn't seem to be any organizing principle. Is there any way that we could produce those numbers somehow, from some very small number, you know, in a very simple, direct way? And it turns out that we can. And this is a miracle. I think it's a miracle, and it's a very good example of what the Langlands program is about. When I say that there is a hidden connections between two subjects, number theory and harmonic analysis, here's how it works. Harmonic analysis to the rescue. All of these numbers could be obtained as coefficients of one function. And you see, this function, it might look at first glance awfully complicated, but actually it's not. Because see, what you do is you have a new variable, q. It's a variable. It's like usually we take x, y, z, and so on, but now I want to use q because I used x and y before. So it, we just like, in mathematics, we like to use Q in this context. Q is just a variable. And then we form this product, okay? So bear with me. So you take first Q, then you take 1 minus Q. You take 1 minus Q squared. You take 1 minus Q cube, 1 minus Q to the fourth, and you square them. Then you also take Q to the 11, Q to the 22, Q to the 33, and so on. So 1 minus Q to positive number, and 1 minus Q to 11 times positive number, and all squared. Very easy. You can generate, you know, you can write a small one line of code which will generate this thing. And then you open the brackets in the usual way, and you collect the terms with the same degree of power of Q. So for example, if you open those brackets, you will see that Q to the 5, the coefficient will be 1. Q to the 6 will be 2, and so on. So very easy. It's really a very simple rule how to generate all these numbers all at once. In other words, just one line contains them all, contains all these coefficients. And it turns out that the numbers we were looking for, solutions, numbers of solutions of this cubic equation, are actually all encoded here. Namely, this number we were looking for, exactly the coefficient in front of the corresponding power of Q. So you see, for example, remember, for it's not number of solutions, it's rather this number, this deficit, so to speak, the discrepancy. So for example, for p equal 5, remember, it was 4 solutions, so 5 minus 4 is 1. And so, and lo and behold, in front of q to the 5, you got 1. And so likewise, you know, for 7, you have 7 minus 9, it's negative 2. And lo and behold, you have minus 2 times q to the 7, and so on. So you can extract any number without doing any calculation with the cubic equation, you get this. This is what Langlais actually, in another article, he said mathematics is about finding order out of seeming chaos. And this is what this does. It's sort of like kind of a source code for this cubic problem. But this function lives in the world of harmonic analysis. And that's what I mean by finding connections between the two. And so in fact, for experts, the series actually converges for complex numbers less than 1 in absolute value. And we get a function on the unit disk, which is called a modular form of weight 2. And it has beautiful properties with respect to some group of symmetries on the unit disk, which is depicted here. So the values of this function are completely determined by its values on any of these curved triangles. So this is called, so Shimura-Taniyama-Weil conjecture is something which was proposed before Langlais by at different times by these three mathematicians, Shimura, Taniyama, and Weil. It could be viewed as a special case now of, in retrospect of the Langlais program. And it's really very important because it was used to prove Fermat's last theorem. And of course now I'm especially happy to talk about this because we are now in the Andrew Wiles building, and I think Andrew Wiles is here also. So this is perfect because he and Richard Taylor in 1995 proved Shimura, Taniyama, Weil conjecture. In most cases, and even earlier, my colleague at UC Berkeley, Ken Ribbett, showed that implied actually Fermat's last theorem. So it is a big deal. It's not just Fermat's last theorem. 350 years. It took 350 years. So finally, we know what it was that Fermat wanted to write on that margin. So. You know, it was a Twitter-style proof, you know, so I only have 140 characters. I have a beautiful proof, but I only have 140 characters to spare, so I'm sorry. Oops, I don't have more space. So, but now we have it, so. And this, you could say that this is only one special case of the Langlais program. So in Langlais program, you have many, many fascinating, beautiful, miraculous results like this, which we're still trying to prove and understand. And there is a lot more. I'm kind of going a little over time because I'd like to talk to have a chance to talk to Marcus and also take your questions. But just to say a couple of words that the same cubic equation that we looked at, but we looked at solutions with modulo prime numbers, you can also look for solutions with values in real numbers or complex numbers. And interesting thing happens with complex numbers, what you get is a beautiful picture like this, a torus, a surface of a donut, Homer Simpson's favorite Riemann surface. There are other Riemann surfaces as well with two holes, like kind of a Danish pastry, or three holes, like a pretzel, and so on, right? And so there's this beautiful geometric theory which goes in parallel with the theory which we talked about, which I talked about earlier. So Langlais program, what happened is, in 1967, Robert Langlais, the man you saw in the picture earlier, wrote a letter to an eminent mathematician, André Weil, in which he laid out these ideas. But since then, these ideas sort of took life of their own and propagated to many other areas of mathematics, geometry, representation, theory of Lie algebras and quantum loops, and quantum physics. And this is something most recent. Oops, whoa, look at that. So That was unexpected. But quantum physics, and this is interesting because for those of you who heard Langlands talk, he talked about what he called mirror symmetry. It was slightly disparaging. Disparaging was like, yeah, well, we still don't fully understand it. But in that sense, he's right. But I think it's a beautiful theory. I will talk about it, by the way, tomorrow at our conference at 1:30, and it will be more technical mathematical talk in which I will try to discuss this connection which emerged very recently between the Langlands program and what's called the electromagnetic duality. So they turn out to be very closely connected. And so I want to end by, you know, if there is only one thing you remember from this talk, I want you to remember this picture of mathematics as a jigsaw puzzle and connecting these different continents of mathematics, you know. But for young people in the audience, and of course we're all young, but you know, for younger people in the audience, when I was a student, oftentimes it looked like all the major problems have been solved, and so what am I doing here, you know? But actually, the more you study this, the more you understand how little we know. So in fact, there is practically we know almost nothing. And so in that sense, it's such a, I hope that many of you will come and solve some of those remaining problems. And so this brings me to this beautiful quote from Isaac Newton, talked about this undiscovered ocean of truth. So that he, to himself, he said, appeared as a little boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst this great ocean of truth lay undiscovered before me. So let's go out and discover more of those truths. Thank you very much.
I actually reviewed this book for Nature, and I mean, one of the beautiful things about it, I think, is first of all, just to be able to explain something like the Langlands conjecture. I mean, it's one of our great unsolved problems and a real challenge to try and explain to a general audience what it's all about. But I think your example is really that little seed showing just what an amazing connection between two completely different areas of mathematics. I mean, it's a bit like an archaeologist discovering patterns in two different areas.
But
I think the other thing I really said was great about this book in my review was these two narratives. One's a sort of mathematical narrative, but you also write this very personal narrative of how you became a mathematician. And actually, the first chapter starts off, how does one become a mathematician? There are many ways that this can happen. Let me tell you how it happened to me. It might surprise you, but I hated math when I was at school. And that's quite a brave opening. So how actually did you become a mathematician if actually at school you hated it?
Well, as I realize now, I did not hate math. I hated what I thought math was, what was taught to me as math. And at the very beginning of the book, I say, imagine an art class in which they teach you only how to paint fences and walls, but never show you the paintings of the great masters. And they say, that's all there is to art. So then, of course, you will say, I hate art, but you'll be just saying, I hate painting the fence, but you don't know that there is something else. And that's how it was for me. I didn't know there was anything beyond the kind of stuff that we studied at school, which if you think about it, the mathematics that we study at school, practically all of it is more than 1,000 years old. And I find it scandalous. And what I also find surprising is that I myself only realized that recently. So somehow we take so many things for granted, and we can't even imagine that things could be done in a different way. But why not? So we study Euclidean geometry, you know, which is 2,300 years old. And of course, Euclid was great. Elements was a very important book because it was not just for geometry, but he sort of showed us the way of how we think about mathematics, how we prove mathematical theories, how we create theories. But also Homer, for example. I don't mean Homer Simpson. I mean Homer, you know, Odyssey, you know. So he laid the foundation, around the same time, laid the foundation of the Western canon of literature. And we study Homer, and we respect and love Homer. But we don't stop at Homer in our literature classes, right? We also read T.S. Eliot and Salinger and many others. So why is it that we don't study mathematicians, that we don't study any geometry beyond Euclidean geometry? Why don't we study Riemannian geometry, which is the little donuts and spheres and Danish pastry, and understanding that maybe, you know, the two meridians on a sphere always intersect, unlike parallel lines on a plane and things like that. So, but I can go on and on about this for hours. So going back to your question, so that's where I was. So, but because the subject is so abstract, we need someone. I think what we need is someone to guide us into this world of mathematics. And I was lucky when I was 15 years old, there was someone who was a friend of my family. I lived in a small town near Moscow, and he opened the door for me because I was interested in physics, in elementary particles. And he said, do you know how physicists came up with these ideas, with these revolutionary ideas about quarks and other particles? And I said, I didn't know. He opened the book and he showed me. And there were diagrams, which I had seen before, but without any explanation in popular books. But here there was clearly a coherent theory, and it was a mathematical theory. It was formulas and equations, which I couldn't understand. But it was clear to me that those were the glimpses of this hidden world, which was hidden from me, you know? And he said, you think what they teach you at school is mathematics? No, this is mathematics.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened for me. So I would say the reason I wrote this book, in some sense, is that, you know, this guy, by the way, his name, Yevgeny Yevgenievich Petrov, and I kind of wanted to make it sound a little bit like Russian novels, you know, like when you read War and Peace and so on. You had all these patronymic names, but this is his real name. So I would like to be Yevgeny Yevgenievich for my readers, you know, in some sense, maybe to help them to open this door, to open the portal. And I imagine you know, Marcus, since you have written how many? Three.
Yes, yes.
Very successful books. I imagine that you have to grapple with this issue as well of how do you convey these ideas in an accessible way.
But I think, and it's interesting, you know, why did you decide to write this book? Because, you know, we're mathematicians, we spend a lot of time sort of at conferences talking to our fellow mathematicians, and actually, you know, one of the books that, I mean, I had a similar experience where a teacher at school took me aside and said, you should find out what maths is really about, because it's not what we're doing in the classroom.
Exactly.
So I think probably all of us as professional
mathematicians... But some of us are not so lucky. That's the
and
point.
Actually,
right?
That's one of the reasons I chose to actually... take a step aside and write the first book, The Music of the Primes, which is about another, well, connected, the Riemann hypothesis.
Which, by the way, will be available outside.
Yes, I'm sort of riding on the back of your coattails. I'm sorry about that. Yeah,
books
are also available after this as well as your book. But I was a little bit to pay back. I mean, my teacher was Mr. Baleson, and I wanted to sort of pay him back for actually having given me this key to this secret garden. And so that was partly why I wrote The Music of the Primes. But I think there was one of the books he recommended to me was A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy. A lovely book.
Beautiful.
About how creative an act it is to be a mathematician. Mm-hmm. But actually that book starts with, it is a melancholy experience for a professional mathematician to find himself writing about mathematics. The job of a mathematician is to do mathematics, not to talk about it. And I think.
But I disagree with him.
Yes, okay, good.
I disagree with him. I mean, the book is beautiful, of course. But I think he was exaggerating. And I think this is a problem, because I think, honestly, we mathematicians, we are kind of an elite. We are an elite, and we have to understand this, that we know something which 99.9% of people have no idea even exists. Not let alone the details of it. They don't even know it exists. Like I said, 1,000 years worth of essential knowledge in mathematics is a blind spot for everyone. And that's why everyone goes and says, oh, I hate math, or don't talk to me about this stuff, you know, I'm so bad at math. They were bad at painting the fence, and obviously, you know, humiliated by teachers and so on, so it's not their fault. But the point is that how can we allow this to continue and to go on? It's a scandal, I mean, really, that we allow this to go on. Why is it that other scientists, like biologists and physicists, are out there talking about their stuff, and our stuff is no less important? I think maybe in some ways it's more important, because I think it's at the foundation of everything. It's a universal language, like we talked about earlier. So, but there is this thing that people kind of look, okay, well, Hardy was saying, well, now that I write about mathematics, people will say, that's because I cannot do any more mathematics. So, but that's not the case. But I also think that this, if we start, we should reevaluate ourselves, what we know about mathematics to be. I feel like it's almost we work in this gold mine, okay? So we spend a whole day trying to find this gold nugget. And it's hard work, it's super hard, and sometimes we don't find it. We may spend years and years and don't find it. So it's really heartbreaking, and we have to go through a lot of dirt to get to it. So finally, when we find it, we are so tired that we don't even have time to look at it and appreciate it and say, wow, this is amazing, let alone go and show it to other people, right? But we have to, because I think when we do that, when we reflect on what we really do, this will help us also to solve problems which we think are unsolvable.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think actually I thought my experience of writing The Musings of the Primes was going to be one which is just going to be helpful for the general public in understanding maths. But actually, it helped me understand my own subject in a way that I had to ask myself questions that I hadn't really considered before in the writing of that. Did that happen with you?
Exactly.
It changed your perspective on the problems that you're working on?
Yes, it changed my perspective on problems I work on, but also it changed my perspective on what mathematics is. For example, I never really thought deeply about where mathematical ideas and truths and entities and concepts come from. Because, you know, you deal with this stuff on a daily basis. So, of course, then you close books and go to sleep, you know, whatever, have dinner and so on, and you wake up in the morning and you brush your teeth and maybe even floss or whatever. And then you start again, right? But you don't have time to ask, where is this coming from? Why is it? Was Pythagoras' theorem invented by Pythagoras? Was it discovered by Pythagoras? So as I was writing this book, I started to think about this, and I was amazed how fascinating these questions are. And we don't think about this enough. And I think we have to, because who else? So we kind of delegated to philosophers. And, you know, I respect philosophers. Some of my best friends are philosophers. And they're doing a great job for us, but we know so much more than them. We have to help them. I mean, in mathematics, not in general. But, you know, because you have to know a certain amount of, I mean, some people maybe study philosophy of mathematics without knowing, making a point of insisting on not knowing what mathematics is. Perhaps there are such philosophers. But this is not the right approach. I think one should be informed by mathematics. And I think we should set aside, I think each of us should set aside 10% of our time to think about these deep philosophical questions. Not why are we here, and what's life about, and so on. These are too complicated. But let's look at the question, what is mathematics? Let's spend 10% of our time. I think the consequences will be tremendous, because first of all, this will help us, I think, also to see more clearly the problems we are working on. We'll see the big picture.
Yes, I mean, I think your statement about from Cantor about the freedom of mathematics.
Right.
I mean, there is a lot of freedom, and that's what makes it a creative subject, of course.
But not random. So some people say, well, every model, you just choose axioms, but that's not how it happens either. So what is it that we're doing? Why are we pursuing this and not that? What part of it is intuition? What part of it is solid, based on solid foundations?
Yes, and it's interesting when you started with the idea of the aliens. I mean, there's a kind of feeling like, yeah, well, some things are probably basic which do communicate across cultures and across perhaps even the cosmos. I mean, for example, Carl Sagan uses the primes as his way for an alien culture to say hello, because that surely can't be random, although maybe it was just generated by some large unitary matrix.
Right.
I think. But actually, on the other hand, the stories we start to tell about these numbers do involve a kind of sense of aesthetics and a sense of the miracle of that connection. Now, that's a kind of an emotional reaction
that you've had.
And that's why, you know, it's not just math, it's love.
That's right.
I mean,
Exactly.
Do you think that's an important part?
And that's the part. So that's, you know, people ask me, what is the connection between love and math? You know, because they say, well, everybody hates, you know. So I joke sometimes, I say, you know, math and love are kind of similar because, you know, it's simple at first, but then it can get awfully complicated. But, you know, more seriously, I actually do believe that these are the two forces which kind of make us human. You know, like, what is it that makes us human? I mean, you start to think about it. I mean, of course, we have all various, you know, we love our children, we have, you know, we have to breathe, you know, but all of those things, like other animals, for example, also do that. But there is no evidence that aliens can do a animals can do the language program, or they can maybe count up to five or something. But once it gets real mathematics, other animals cannot do it, as far as we know. So it's something which makes us human, but also mathematical truths are the same for everyone. And this is something, it's such a powerful idea, which I must admit, I have been a mathematician all my life. It only dawned on me as I was writing this book that actually all of this, mathematical theories have no shelf life. You know, in physics is very important, but physical theories change and get updated. Pythagoras' theorem is not going to get updated. It's a squared plus b squared equals c squared. It's not tomorrow, it's not going to be c cubed, you know? It's still going to be c squared. And so Einstein's relativity theory now is our best theory of gravity, but who knows? Maybe someone will come.
I remember looking at the model of the universe in the 80s when we were growing up as students. It is fundamentally,
It is the same, and it is the same for everyone. It doesn't matter which culture, which religion, which language we speak. Gender, whatever.
But do you think that's a reason that we're a sort of product of our own success? The education system means that we always start with the Greeks, and so it's and how far can you get? Perhaps that's actually cause the problems that you mentioned right at the beginning.
Yeah, but we have to find the right balance. Like I said, you know, we have to read Homer, but we have to also read modern literature. Yeah. And likewise, we have to appreciate Euclid and Pythagoras, but we should also appreciate Riemann, for example. And Langlands.
Perhaps we should put Langlands in the curriculum.
This, I think, is very important.
Well, I personally think we should. But now, the other amazing thing about this is, as I said, it's a very personal story of how you became a mathematician. But there's a very particular sort of document in here, which I think is incredibly important, which is your experiences growing up in Russia and the prejudice you experienced having Jewish ancestry. For me, it was one of the most moving parts of the book, just the battle you had to become a mathematician. Could you tell us a little bit about just what you had to go through in order to be where you are here today?
Yes, so as I mentioned, when I was 15, I sort of fell in love with mathematics because someone opened the doors for me, and I saw this beautiful world, and I started studying mathematics, and I decided that I wanted to be a mathematician. And so a year later, I applied to Moscow University, Mechmat, mathematics and mechanics program, which was the only place really to study pure mathematics in Moscow at the time. And I was very excited about this. And so, but there was an obstacle, which I did not expect, which is that I was failed at the entrance exams. And this was a systematic policy at the time, which actually persisted for many years, of failing and discriminating against applicants. Jewish applicants, by a certain definition. What does it even mean, Jewish? It was not certainly religious by religion, it was just by, in my case, by my last name. My last name is my father's name, and my father is Jewish. But not religious, but, you know, it was just by ethnicity, by blood. For some reason, that was decided, and a lot of people became, were subjected to this. So. And I describe in my book this grueling four-hour exam.
An extraordinary document, actually, the time you spend being grilled by these people, you getting all the questions right, and yet they would find a definition of a circle. If you missed just one little, all the points, the direct
points
are,
all the points.
I mean, it's an amazing story.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, see, for me, sometimes people tell me sometimes that maybe for me, it was a good thing because I found my own way around this obstacle, so it actually hardened me. It made me gave me even more resolve. I wanted to become a mathematician, and they put this wall against in front of me. So I had to scale this.
I mean, you literally scaled it. That's wonderful. You end up not at Moscow State University, but the University of
Oil and Gas School.
And there's a wonderful story. In my second week, my classmate came up to me. Hey, we're going to Kirillov's course at MGU, the Moscow State University. Want to come with us? Kirillov was a famous mathematician. Of course, I wanted to attend his lectures, but I had no idea that this would be possible. The grand building of MGU was heavily guarded by police. One needed to have special ID to get in. No worries, my classmate said. We'll scale the fence. That sounded dangerous and exciting, so I said, sure.
Yes, it's true. You know, someone commented, they said, you know, in the United States, they guard the building to keep students in, you know, in the Soviet Union, they try to keep them out. But yes, that happened. We had to scale the fence on the side of the building and go through the kitchen.
Now, you eventually ended up in America. You
got yes.
Now, I went to Russia. I was a PhD student, finished in 89, and I went to conferences in Russia around that period. It was very exciting. The mathematical community in Russia was opening up, and Russian mathematics was incredibly strong.
That's right.
But of course, so many Russian mathematicians left to go to the West. I mean, what is the state of Russian mathematics now in your mind? I mean, is it...
Well, it obviously was depleted. I mean, there was a great school, but people were subjected to this kind of discrimination, a lot of people. And, you know, as I said, maybe for me it was, in some sense, it helped me because it made me even stronger. And, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, kind of. So I was able to... And then I was lucky again because there was a great mathematician, Dmitry Fuchs, who took me under his wing and gave me my first problem, which I solved, and I worked with Boris Feigin, who was my teacher and became my long-time collaborator. But other students were not so lucky, so this is the problem. So, and this is the reason why I write about this, because I don't have a grudge. I'm fine. I did well. You know, I'm okay. But what I'm really angry about really is about how many kids, you know, with the glimmer in their eyes, you know, who wanted to become mathematicians and had done nothing wrong, just because they had a Jewish name or they came from a Jewish family. They were so unfairly, you know, discriminated against, and they were, many of them were destroyed. There was just such a horrible experience that they could never quite recover from. So I want people to know about this. That's the first thing. So now, luckily now, as far as I know, in Russia, in today's Russia, this is not happening. So, but maybe nobody, but now talented youth wants to go abroad, wants to go to other countries. And many of the mathematicians left. There are still some who remain, and this is wonderful because, of course, in Russia there is a very deeply rooted tradition of mathematics. And I hope, I would like to go one day and also teach a class and help students there and so on. So I think it will come back, it will rebound, but for now it's sort of a kind of on the low, so on the low side of the wave.
Yeah. Well, I think it is an amazing testament of that period in history, and also a wonderful story of a great mathematical story as well. So, anyway, I'd like to open up for questions from the audience for Edward about maths, love, politics, anything that you'd like to ask. So, hands up, and we'll.
Or we can ask Marcus also.
Yeah. Yes. I'm just going to repeat the question, so everyone. So, it's a teacher, a question from a maths teacher who's feeling a little bit of embarrassed about the fact that she has to teach all of this rather boring stuff, which I think is actually the government's fault, not yours. But yeah. So, what should she be teaching to her students when she goes in tomorrow morning?
Very good. So.
Yes.
But yes.
Yeah. And send it to Michael Gove. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify something that. Sometimes people think, when I say that, people think that I'm blaming the teachers, but I'm not blaming the teachers. I blame myself, I blame other mathematicians for not doing enough to educate, to help teachers, to give teachers the right tools so that they, you know, because they are not given, I don't know about how it is in the United Kingdom, but I know better about the United States. In the United States, teachers are put in a very difficult position because the rules are constantly changing, there are different testing systems and so on introduced, and they're like, oh my gosh, and then today is this, tomorrow is that. They don't have time even to think about this, what is the material, and they're not given enough. Textbooks are awful and so on and so forth. So it's not going to happen overnight. So we're not going to solve it overnight because this is a product. This is a product of something which has been going on for centuries, I would say, but certainly for decades. And so what I think we should do really is just little steps. We all make small steps. We mathematicians make small steps in spending some time thinking about what is it that we're doing, and maybe we should tell others what it is. You know, parents maybe should learn also about mathematics and kind of become aware of what their children are missing, because I think what's going to happen is going to be solved by a kind of popular uprising. Right now, maybe there is 0.01% or 0.1% of people who know what mathematics is about. What if it's 10%? Then they say, okay, maybe I don't know this stuff, but I want my children to know this stuff. Then there will be enough people to go and affect the change. That's what I think we should do. And likewise with teachers, I hate to say anything because I have such a respect and admiration for a profession of a teacher, and I know how difficult it is. So I certainly don't have the solution. I don't have the solution. If anything, I would like to learn from teachers about what I should do to help, you know. But obviously, first of all, it's not bad stuff. You know, Euclid is Euclid. You know, it's not, like I said, mathematics has no shelf life. His book, Elements, is just as important and just as alive today as it was 2,300 years ago. So there's nothing wrong in teaching that. What I'm saying is we should diversify. We should also talk about some of the stuff which happened recently. Okay, so in other words, it's okay to teach that. The good thing, important thing, is to teach it as not through memorization and not through just solving problems and it's all set in stone, but to teach it as a live organism, as a struggle of ideas, that these things were not clear. You know, to people who were developing them, right? But also now there are resources, there are books. I mean, you have two authors in front of you, right? But also, I mentioned Numberphile. Numberphile is a great resource. One can go, and kids love it. I know from Brady Haran, who is the one who, the producer of this channel, that he gets lots of emails from kids. And I got some because I did a few videos with him. So they're all short, most of them under 10 minutes, and describe some concept of mathematics. And the point is that this is a portal. You cannot explain everything in 10 minutes. But it will spur some interest. So the kids say, oh, wow, this is... For example, there was one video which many of you may have seen about the sum 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5. And of course, there was a lot of criticism about how it was explained and so on. But I think it's wonderful that there is this idea that you can sum up all the positive integers And it's not there is a certain context in which there is a regularized way to sum them up so that the answer is minus 1 over 12 and not infinity. Most people have never heard of this. So this is such a great, for a kid, I think, to appreciate, to see, wow, there is this in mathematics? Wow. So in other words, that would be something maybe if you have like 5 minutes in your class left or something, which I know is difficult, but to show them something like this, I think could go a long way. All right.
Other questions? Yes, question from a mathematical philosopher who you insulted earlier. So I'm just going to repeat the questions and make sure everyone's... the beginning of the 20th century, we had a lot of mathematicians who were deeply interested in philosophy. Why is that not the case now, do you think?
Because we are abdicating, our responsibilities. We are not doing our job. I mean, that's what I think. I mean, those people, the greats, like Hilbert and Gödel, they were... connected to philosophy. They understood that it was important. But of course, one could say that because they had this enterprise of finding sort of rigorous axiomatic system and building this beautiful edifice of mathematics from scratch, and that didn't work out. So I think what happened is that then people were kind of disappointed and it was kind of a little bitter. And then they said, you know what? There was a backlash against that. They said, you know what, let's not waste time on this. I want to solve a cubic equation. Let's just solve the cubic equation. Let other people worry about this. I think that's what happened. But, this is not going to be solved overnight, but this is important. We have to work on this. We have to understand what is this all about. We would like to understand, I hope, what this is all about, what the world is about, what's really going on. And I think mathematics is one of the important pieces of the puzzle. And one where we can actually analyze things rigorously. So, in other words, absolutely great point that mathematicians are not doing this enough, and there are some reasons for this, but I think these are kind of bogus reasons. We should really
We're putting our head in the sand.
Putting our hand in the sand. That's what we're doing. Yes.
I will repeat the question.
Repeat the question.
apparently we're not very good at love, mathematicians, but a third of new marriages are decided by algorithms, how can we actually use our mathematical tools to increase the gene pool?
Right.
What's the dangerous
Well, I think that,
question.
First of all, about mathematicians
Over
not
to you, Edward.
Not being good lovers, I think it's a misconception.
Yes, and I do
there
recommend...
There are counterexamples.
I recommend, in addition to this book, looking at the extraordinary film that Edwards made, which is called Rites of Love and Math, I think, which
We just had a UK premiere in London.
Yes, UK premiere in
three
London,
days,
exactly.
Three days ago.
But it's before the 10 o'clock watershed, so we couldn't show a clip here, unfortunately.
This is a very important point, first of all, that you're making about algorithms running our lives. And it's not just about, the dating sites, but even more mundane things like buying books and renting videos and movies and so on, right? So, and I think that's one of the things where, when I talk about this, people find this as kind of a compelling argument, why we should know something about math, because, look, I mean, everything gets more and more defined by mathematics. So, and I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but this is a fact. It is happening, and we have to be aware. And someone said to me, but, why are you advocating that people should know about mathematics? For example, we fly on airplanes, right? But we don't know how to fly airplanes. So we use it, but we let others do it for us. Why should it be different for mathematics? And my point is that it's not about learning how to fly an airplane. It's about knowing that we are on the airplane.
Yes.
So that's what it is. It's just that knowing where we are, being aware of what's going on. And this algorithm thing that you mentioned is, of course, huge. But, of course, since my book is called Love and Math, some people take it as an indication that maybe I have a secret formula in the book for finding a perfect partner or for finding love. But that's not the case. And I don't believe that there is a formula which would describe love. There could be a formula for matching, things and so on. But this is just as, you meet somebody. It used to be that you meet somebody randomly, or maybe you meet somebody through your friends, and now you meet it through an algorithm. So in some sense, it's all in the same category. It's not that different. But I think, so my point rather is not that math can describe love, but it's rather that there is some love built into math a priori, because, like I said earlier, because the mathematical truths are universal truths. Timeless universal truths, which belong to all of us. And so, you know, in principle, if I meet somebody that I never met before and I don't know who they are, where they come from, they may not even speak the same language as I speak. So what is there that, what is it that we have in common? Well, the whole body of mathematics that has been discovered up to now belongs to all of us, to both of us, or to all of us. And it's the same. So it's something that, you know, we can hold on to.
I think that was my experience going to Russia, because I remember going to this conference in the middle of Siberia, and there was nobody who spoke English. But actually, we were able to communicate, and we shared our stories, and it was an amazing experience. I think we've got time for one last question, which was the woman here. Yeah, I think so. This is the question about the ethical uses of mathematics, and it's interesting because at the moment there's quite a debate in Britain about should mathematicians be working with GCHQ or NSA.
That's right.
So, do you think that it's important that mathematicians should think about the ethical side of what?
Very important question. So, you know, and there is a recent precedent: physicists who were driven purely by theoretical, you know, pursuit. Wanted to understand, you know, how elementary how the world worked and atoms and so on, just stumbled upon nuclear energy, and then you know, so the result, this monstrous thing, was created, the nuclear bomb, and they actually had to deal with this, and they did, and they were, you know, some of the greatest physicists like Bohr and Einstein and so on. They understood their responsibility that they have to try to, you know, keep it from destroying the world. And I think, but I think we mathematicians are now in the same position, but we are kind of behind the curve on this, I think. And my point, but my point is, so there is a debate, like you said, about NSA and GCHQ here in Britain. And some people have suggested that we severe ties, for example, in the United States with NSA, and we kind of boycott them, boycott the NSA. But I think it's actually the opposite. My feeling is that it should be the opposite, because my impression is, my guess is that the reason why this kind of things happened were, apparently, according to the reports, that weaknesses were deliberately introduced into widely used encryption algorithms, which is really is like poisoning the well. Because, you know, so you're trying to achieve a particular objective, but in the meantime, you're creating, you know, a very bad situation for everyone, and nobody is aware of this. So I think that people who are the decision makers, they may not have fully understood what they were doing. Mm. And it reminds me also, I think, a parallel, I'd like to make a parallel to the economic crisis, the global economic crisis, because I think it's the same mechanism at play, where you have mathematicians, in the case of economic crisis, they're called quants, you know, these mathematicians who create those models, but they were not the decision makers. It was other people on Wall Street and so forth, who apparently many of them were not really aware of what's going on. But then when it happened, when these models were misused, they did not weigh the risk and to the benefit and so on, right? And didn't understand, but they used them anyway. And when it happened, they blamed the quants and said, oh, it's mathematicians' fault because they created these models. But mathematicians were not responsible for the decision making. And likewise, I think, in a security situation with NSA and so on, I would like to know whether people who make the decisions were actually fully aware of what was going on. And that's why I think our role rather would be to help and advise.
Step and up to the plate.
That's right, and help, and maybe help people who are the decision makers to explain what are the consequences.
Yeah.
So that they take it more seriously, and maybe that way we could avoid. But either way, I think we are facing some very serious ethical issues here right now. And we have to, so in philosophical questions are important, but perhaps these ethical questions are even more important. So I completely agree with you.
Well, thank you so much, Edward, for sharing your love affair with maths. And let's give Edward a great round of applause. Thank you.